curious, from the time that you became interested in Buddhism, what different methods have you used for training the mind for calm and insight? Did it change over the years when you came to Bhantan? Did it change your practices and all?
Yeah, at first I started, I was ordained at first in Wat Phat Nam, and I used method there, which is the Parikamma Samarahan. And then you go from the nostril here to the corner of the eye, then into the center of the head, you know, and down to the throat, and down to the, about below the navel, just about the navel. And you pass to up to a point about the solar plexus. And keep your attention on that internally. The idea is that after time you'll see a limiter, a light limiter. But I wasn't very good at doing that because my mind doesn't work in that way. After doing that, if one sees this light limiter, then you have to see another limiter in the middle of it and coming out, another one. Then you see the human body and the devata body all going up the whole lot like that. But the thing is, I couldn't see the reasoning behind this and what was meant to be happening. I didn't know whether you had to create these bodies by your imagination or whether they were natural things that could arise of themselves. Because of that, I wasn't very confident in it. And I changed to Anapanasati. And with Anapana, yes, that was all right. I got reasonably good results. This was 41 years ago. And then I was in England for 6 years, and then I came out again. I was about 1 year in Wat Phat Nam. After that I came here and I've been here since. Now, under Tana Chan, I found that my understanding of Dhamma changed. It was peculiar because previously I'd written to some people in England. They'd ask me questions and I'd answer them. And they kept the letters, and later on they sent them out. I think they went to the publishing, they didn't think of it. They went to the publishing world. But what I found was that the letters prior to coming here were much more sort of spread, eclectic. But after coming here they became much more in line, much more developed. And it was interesting because I hadn't noticed that happening. And it was clear in the letters, not publicly. And the actual practice, the samadhi practice and so on, when I came here I went on with Anapana. I can't say I was very good at it because my mind works more in terms of thinking to forward the direction of wisdom. I got some results, yes, certainly. But I can't say that I got very, very deep in samadhi or anything like that. But later on I changed to using wisdom and investigating. And that did come to give quite good results. The method of investigating I used was various. First of all, I started on the body concentration. And that's a very valuable practice. And I reckon that most people should use it. I also started investigating the senses. Because I liked asking questions. And I asked the question, well, how do I know the world? And so I sort of thought, well, through the senses. When you see through the senses, you have to ask, how do your senses work? What happens when you sense something, when you see something, when you hear something? And the conclusion one comes to is that the world we don't know. The world is something we don't contact even. What we know is the world that we have inside. because all sensation comes in through the senses, through the citta. The citta knows me. Within that knowing is where we have the world. And we build up the world from the internal sensations we see, and it's stored in memory. And we've got an enormous amount of memory dating back to when we were that high. And this memory that we've got there has gone out in all sorts of directions. And we've been very concerned to get to know everything that we can. The reason we get to know everything that we can is first of all for security. If we know about things and we find security in things, then if there's any change, we immediately recognize it. And we can see that, and then we can become aware of that change. And that change may be a danger. So every change that takes place, we want to get to know it as well. And we're constantly updating this memory. All the time. It's also, memory is essential, because if we're in an environment such as this, we look around, we see the environment, we get to know it. And then if we want anything, we immediately know where to go to get it. It's there in memory, it's all set up for it. You can see what happens if you go to a foreign country where you don't know the language. You go there, all the signs, you can't understand what they say. You don't know the customs of the people. So I'm very hesitant and looking around all the time trying to find out, how does this work, how does that work, what do they think, what way do they go about. And this, we're wanting to build up that memory to get a knowledge of that part, so that we know what to do and how to act. Because of that, we must see that memory is very, very important. And memory comes through the senses. And it's these senses that tell us what to remember. And an enormous amount of our thinking is based on memory. We see something, we think about it, then to identify it, we must go to memory. And then when we've identified it, we think about it. Again, we go to memory. We may associate it with external sensations, but those sensations have to be identified by memory. And it goes on like that. Memory is very important. People in the past have translated memory as perception. Well, it's not entirely incorrect, but really the best translation is memory. Samya, memory. This is the 30th Kanda. It's very important. This is the sort of thing I did quite a lot in my practice, finding out, looking. But I didn't stick just to that. I went inside as well. And the important thing here is to get to know what things are. Not merely by physiology, but by experience and feeling. This is very important, this area here. Mm-hmm. This is where the Dhamma bears fruit. For example, we say that thoughts arise in the heart. That doesn't mean to say in the physical heart and the pump. But it means to say in that heart which is in the image of the body that we've got in our minds. And that image is, we can say, a subtle body. And in that, we've got the image of the heart. And then the heart is the natural seat for the citta. And the citta goes calm, that's the natural seat. When the citta is disturbed, it can go anywhere. When it's calm, it will come back to here. That's why the heart is so important. That was more or less the kind of practice I've done in the past. The samatha is more or less valuable depending on the character. Some people need a lot of it, and need less. But the matter is always necessary. One mustn't think, as some people say, that it was but an eye, but do not samadhi. That's all wrong. That's one-sided. One needs both. But the amount you need of both will depend very much on the character of the person and what they need. It's like the middle way. There's a lot of muddle in the middle way. Because people have got the idea that it's a sort of old-style English compromise. And it isn't. What the middle way means is that any time we have kilesas, kilesas pull us away from the middle way. So we've got to use a practice which brings it back to the middle way. This is where the Dutandas come in, very, very helpful, very important. If one has a lot of greed, then you have to contemplate the body, see the loathsomeness of it, and one should have the Dutanda of, well, those Dutandas connected with food and things of that sort, to counteract that greed. And whatever is out of balance, one should put the necessary corrective force into play to get it back to balance. But that also means that as that tendency is overcome, there's less and less need for the Dutanda. So that the time comes when one doesn't need to practice. And one has to recognize this. There's no point in trying to develop counterintuitive practice to the kilesas, and then just going on solidly forever doing that. There's no point in it. If it doesn't work, then we have to find something else. And the way of karmatana is the way of being resourceful. One gets problems in practice. And one has to think up the ways out of those problems for oneself. Now, one only goes to the teacher if it's necessary and one can't think it out. Can't work it out what to do. This is the general way. But resourcefulness in one's practice is very important.
Usually the Thai ashrams recommend building a base of samadhi before investigation, or warn that investigation without a base of samadhi will be rather superficial. But you found that the investigation itself, it was clear enough that the whole process of samatha vipassana would.
Well, you can't sort of say categorically that you've got to do samadhi before panya, because characters differ so much. I mean, this is the regular routine, samadhi before panya, and this is the way the books usually give, because that is the sort of general approach to it. And particularly in the old days, when people were, many of the bhikkhus came from a farming background, and the village background, they'd never learned to think very much. But nowadays it's not like that. People have been taught all sorts of things in school, and they've learned the ways of the cities and the ways of science and all sorts of things. Because of that, people are very much more used to thinking nowadays. This is an advantage and a disadvantage, of course. Because when one tends to think a lot, the kilesas get hold of those thoughts and they turn to their advantage. And the thoughts go all over the place. But at the same time, that thought can, if one turns it rightly, go into panya, go into the development of panya, anyway. You must understand that panya is not just thinking. Thinking is necessary to panya. Panya is not actually thinking itself. Panya comes up if one's worked a lot on something like the body. When it goes into panya, it's almost as if something turns over, and the seeing is absolutely clear and automatic. The understanding is automatic, and when it's like that, it goes to the chitta, it goes to the heart. If it's just thinking, it doesn't go to the heart. It doesn't drop down. It's as though there's a barrier there.
This subtle body you were speaking of a minute ago, this image we have of our body, is this what is used when investigating the Bible? Working with perceptions?
No, if you're investigating the body, take the body just as you usually think of the body, the physiological body. Because the idea there is to see this body is not a beautiful thing, a desirable thing, something that we should cling on to tightly. At the same time, we must see that this body is necessary instrument, and valuable. Because without it, we haven't got the basis for the mental faculties. Without the body, I mean, when a person dies, they still have knowing. There's knowing there. But they can't think about it. There's no recollection, there's no memory. It's just bare knowing, that's all. And bare knowing is the key to the whole thing, really. The understanding of what that means is very important. But one's got to have this body, and so although one sees it as loathsome, one also sees it as necessary. If one doesn't go like that, one might think, oh, I should commit suicide, or something like that. That's silly. One shouldn't. But the body, seeing it as a body, in the Satipatthana, it says that one contemplates the body in the body. There's one or two ways in which you can take this. You can take it as a body contemplator contemplating the body. That phrase can mean that. But it can also mean that you contemplate the body as the body. Now, the thing to see in this is that if we ask, how do I know the body? There's only one thing we know it by, really, and that's feeling. If you ask yourself, well, how do I know this body? And you get down into it, and you look and you see. All the time, what you get is feeling. Nothing but feeling. So it's really a feeling body. And that is the subtle body. The physical body is the basis for it. But we don't really know the physical body at all. Because any way we want to know in the body, we have to go to feeling. We only know the physical body as an image in mind, as a concept, a theory, which comes from bodies being cut up and you have a look and you see what the bits and pieces look like. But all that is the physical body, and it is the basis, and it's necessary. But it's not the one we know. So if one contemplates the body, one takes the body as the body, as a physical body, as those bits and pieces. But not as feeling. If you take it as a feeling body, then you go to the feelings in the body, which in many cases are quite different from the physical body. They give different sort of ideas about what's in the body. This is quite an important thing. Realize one knows feeling, nothing else. Feeling is the most important sense. There's little doubt about that.
This practice of body investigation, are you using visualization of different parts?
To begin with, you can use visualization, yes. But it can go deeper than that, and it starts to come where the visualization and seeing, they're almost mixed together. It's almost as though you know the parts. It's almost as though when the body's moving, for instance, you can see the parts moving. But it's not seeing just with your eyes, it's seeing with the mind. It's good practice.
is that what you meant earlier on when you said get to know this area, not through physiology but through experience?
Yes, through experience. When I first came here, Sanachan said to me, you should tour around the body. Go touring inside the body. Go wherever you like. Just go in, go all around, round about, look at it here, there, everywhere. He also said that if you keep your mind within the field of Dhamma, I will agree with whatever you do. In other words, one's pretty free there to keep one's mind in the field of Dhamma, go where one wants. With regard to body contemplation, though, one of the things one has to be aware of and to be warned of is that when you do body contemplation, sometimes you will find after doing it, maybe the next day, you start feeling very grumpy and sort of a bit snappy at other people. You don't feel very, very happy about things. And one doesn't know why this is. And one should look and see whether it comes from body contemplation. Because the body contemplation is stirring up the kilesas. It's something the kilesas don't like. And they come back and fight. And because of that, one can get a lot of emotional trouble coming up. And the emotional trouble that comes up will depend on the character again, how much. Some people get very little, some people get a lot of it. But in order to quell that, one should also do another practice, like anapana, or metta, or something of that sort, to sort of calm down and cool off. This was also in accordance with what the Buddha said. He said if one's doing body practice, all right, one should do anapana as well.
You found in your practice from your early years, did you have much anger coming up?
Much?
No. Did you have much anger arising? How did you deal with that?
But anger generally, one has to realize what happens there. This is quite clear, actually, in Patitasamapada. First thing that arises is feeling. And that feeling comes from kamma. The thought kamma of anger. And that feeling arises inside, it's in this area again. And when that feeling arises, there's a feeling of a diminution of self. It's as though one feels as though one's losing face to oneself. Now, when that comes, one scrabbles back to try and get that face back again. And mostly the way people do it is supposing you see someone on the street you don't like, you had a quarrel with them before, and when you get this unpleasant feeling coming, immediately up come the old elements of the quarrel, and you start blaming the person, or blaming this, or blaming the other, or blaming the weather, or something like that. And this is trying to pacify this feeling. But it's the wrong way. And the trouble is that all those thoughts are kamma. And that kamma will produce the same feeling in the future. When the trigger comes for it. When something comes to trigger it off, it just comes back again. So one's getting that same situation coming up time after time. The way to cure this is, first of all, with mindfulness. And the way you do it is that when one gets this feeling, one is mindful of it, and one immediately turns inward and looks at the feeling. One realizes this feeling is just a feeling. This comes up because it's my own damn fault. I've been angry in the past, and this is a result of being angry. And then you watch it, and you say, all right, if it diminishes self, this self's a delusion anyway. So what does it matter? And you don't let your thoughts go out. All the time, the trouble comes because of thoughts going outward. In fact, I reckon that the word asoya means outflow. It's the citta flowing out into the world like that. And when the citta flows out into the world, it gets trouble every time. This is the story of anger, and that's the way to deal with it. But it's not easy, because the kilesas are pretty subtle, pretty clever. When you do anything, they'll try and find a way around it. But still, if one tries that, one can get used to it, and one can begin to see how it works. The thing is to see how anger works for oneself. Greed works in a similar manner. You know, you see something in a brand new television set or whatever it is, and then you look at it, and you don't think much of it. Then afterwards you think, it's quite a good set, man. Go and have a look at it. You go back and, you got a light on it, then, you know. Better than the neighbors have got. then gradually he thinks about it and thinks about it until so some of her hand goes out and grasps it. And then he thinks, oh, I wonder if I've got enough money. It's not expensive. Might do it on credit. And what you've got there is the greed, the kilesas, going out grasping, and they want it, quite regardless of the one who's got to pay it back afterwards. And the thing is, they just want it. They don't care a damn about that one who's got to pay it back afterwards. Pay back in the work he's got to do to get the money to pay it back, and so on. So he gets the thing, and it's very nice for a short time, then he gets used to it. He still has to go on paying it back. Paying back the money. And in the end, he probably wishes he never bought the thing. This is the way of greed. Again, it comes up as feeling, first of all. You just see something, and then there's a feeling. I like it. And before long, you're thinking about it. And it grows and grows and grows.
Being that is your emotional object that I have to work with, it suddenly, once it arises, it's in the space of not caring about wanting to do the festival.
The thing, if you get not caring you want about the practice, you want to see the results of your own karma and what's going to come of it. You must look in this life and check out what dukkhas you had in this life, what discontent. You can probably assess something of what discontent you're going to get. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know if we're going to get cancer, or if we're going to have a car accident, or what. There are all sorts of dangers in the world. We don't know. And I mean, one might think, supposing when one was in a car accident and was completely disabled, how would it be then? We should work. Or perhaps one gets into a situation where one can no longer be a bhikkhu, and can no longer do the practice. And then stuck. And when you look in this world and see what it's like. When I was younger, I used to think, now, I'd like to find an ideal place in this world to live in. So in my mind, I looked around and thought, where is an ideal place in the world? And there isn't one. You look, everywhere you look, there are disadvantages. You can never be sure what's going to happen anyway. In fact, there are dire predictions for the future, and not very far ahead too. Dozens of them, not just one, but dozens. So I don't know. I can't say whether they're going to be true or not, but they could. And if the world blows up in one way or another, what do we do then? I mean, if it's all right now, we've got plenty of food to eat. We've got a good place to live in, reasonable climate, reasonable people round about. All that may go. We can't tell. So we should see the importance of working now, while we can.
Could I bring you back to body investigation and anapanasati for a minute? Is there a structure you would recommend, a way of balancing the two, or is it very much up to the individual to find a way of combining both forms of practice?
Probably the best thing is to develop anapana somewhat first until you get some calm. When you've got some calm and you feel you can get back to that calm again without much difficulty, then investigate the body. And then as you require to, you can use the anapana to just cool himself. So he has to realize there's two ways of doing body concentration. One is more a way of samatha. The other way is the way of vipassana or panya. To do it with samatha, you keep your attention on one part, like skin. And you don't think about it much. You just keep skin. just fixed in mind as much as you can. And that can then act as a parikamba, much in the same way as the word buddho acts as a parikamba. The one advantage this practice has got is that when you do get calm from it, because you've been on a path of the body, it's very easy to turn to punya, to develop into wisdom. The other way of doing the body, of course, is where instead of just taking skin like that, you think, where does this skin come from? What happens if I don't wash it? Is it beautiful or not? What happens if you pull it off? What's it like? And supposing you pull a piece off and leave it there, what happens? Find all the ants going around to eat it. Things like that you think about. This is the way of punya, or developing punya. It isn't actually punya. You develop it. Yeah.
Do you use pain, you know, do you investigate and penetrate into pain to investigate the mind body?
You can, yes. It's a difficult practice. But if a person's very determined, they can do it. I'll tell you what Tanachan said about this. He found while sitting that he got pain in the knees, as many people do. And he determined to investigate that pain, and you must investigate it. It's no good just grinning and bearing it. That won't work. That doesn't do anything. There's no value in just sort of putting up with it like that. What you've got to do is get the investigation going. For example, there's two ways, I'd say. First of all, you can say, the feeling is there. Now, do I feel that? Who is this I that feels? And you realize that if you can do that, you realize that the one who feels it, the one who knows this feeling, and the actual feeling are two different things. It's as though the pain's there, but the one who knows it is up here. And you can ask and say, well, this pain here, all right, it's pain, but am I painful? And you realize that you're not. It's a separation of the two. That's one way. The other way, and it is the deeper way, is to question this pain here, what is it? Where is it? Is it in the bone? Is it in the skin? Is it in the marrow? Is it in the sinews? In the nerves? Where is it? You come to realize by doing that that pain is not a physical thing at all. That the pain is not in any of those there at all. And what one must do when the pain's there is to go on not trying to get rid of the pain. If you want the pain to go, that's done half. So what one does, one goes on with the idea, I want to get to know what pain means. And you go on and on and on with that. If you do this, the pain will get much worse. And it'll get worse probably for about an hour or two. And then it'll break. It'll suddenly stop. And one will get some understanding from it. But one has to go on again, because that's just the first stage. And one then investigates in a different way for oneself. And the pain comes back again, stronger. And again, one has to do it. And this can go on up to about five times. Until the last time, the feeling is as though the whole body's on fire. I was quite sure I was going to die. But if one keeps on at it still, when it breaks then, the understanding is very large, very important. It really does get some deep insight. And one can also get the valuable factor of knowing that there is no pain that I could possibly have that would be worse than that. And because I was able to deal with that, whatever pain arises, I can deal with it. Even when one dies, one knows that one can deal with the pain. And that gives one great confidence.
Imagine all the whole session would take how many hours, by the way?
Oh, sometimes 5 hours.
I'd rather die.
I'm curious on the relationship you've had with
We call Rupu Mahabhu over the years, being here for so long and whatnot.
Yeah.
When you've had obstacles in your practice or questions, do you go to him? Or when you've had certain insights, have you gone to him?
How only, that only very occasionally. Very occasionally. Because nearly all the problems I've had, I've been able to work out myself. So, I mean, going by what he said in his talks and in his books, that itself has brought up an enormous amount of understanding. And that's been very important. Also, I would say some of the things he talks about, they tend to be the problems one's got. And it answers the problems without you even asking. Generally, there's been very little need to ask Tamachan.
What if you've been mostly working out your own problems for yourself, what benefit have you found from staying close to Tamachan for some reason?
When you're with a person like that, there's a lot of influence there. You get the security of being in the presence of somebody of that sort. You also get the example. Also, you know that Tanachan's nature is such that if he sees something wrong, he'll say so straight away. Something's going wrong, he'll say. And that's give one confidence that one's going in the right direction. And he can be quite fierce too. He's got a name for it. I would say it's been very valuable. Very valuable. It's where you've got something, you've got a leader. You follow that leader. It's like that. The trouble is if one's on one's own, there is a tendency to drift. Because it's as though the leader is like a stake firmly rooted in the ground like that. And you know whether you're going away from him or not. You're going away from that stake or not. You know. If you don't have that, there's the danger of drifting. And the trouble is the drift takes place very, very, very gradually. This is one of the dangers of a bhikkhu going back to the West. Unless the bhikkhu is absolutely firm inside, you'll find that the lay people gradually may pull him in their direction. Not deliberately, it's an unconscious thing. But they're always pulling him in their direction. Unless the bhikkhu is absolutely firm, he tends to drift in that direction. And it comes so gradually and slowly that he doesn't recognize it. One needs to be very firm inside. One needs to have what Tanachan called luck come. A basic principle of Dhamma within one. That's it, right.
He says lakkam, is he referring to a level of calmness or a level of insight?
Literally both. He says that at least the person should have experience in samadhi. But usually that's even that's not enough. It needs really that the person has got a sort of basic understanding of the principles of Dhamma. And I mean a basic understanding such that if anything arises, you can go back to that and just work it out and see, yes, I see what I should do. And sees what's right.
When Pudhutan's disciples really have certain amount of progress in practice or certain insights, do they tend to go to him for confirmation or checking to see if these insights are valid?
Some do, yes. Yes. Sometimes Tanachan asks them as a practice. Like most teachers, there are a certain number who develop enough to go and ask Tanachan, talk with Tanachan about their practice. There are a lot who don't. just depends on the amount of practice they do and their skill in practice. Those who have a lot of skill and a lot of ability, they're in the minority, not so many. I mean, all the people went to stay with Sanachan Maya. The numbers who turned into really good teachers were probably far less than the people who went to. Far less. And I mean, they had what I would call ideal conditions in those days. Trouble nowadays, we haven't got ideal conditions. We've got motor roads everywhere and cars can come along, come and visit us all the time. If we want to go anywhere, just jump in the car and we're there. Previously I had to walk. And it was much better in those days really because they had to walk like that. It was, when they got there, they didn't think of all this, they were just sort of buzzing off again. They had to stay in the place for some time. And people got much more, much deeper into things. The trouble nowadays is that things are too easy almost. And because they're too easy, one's much closer to the lay people, to the ways of lay people. And we have all the sort of modern technologies and all sorts of things like that. All these are a distraction from the real root of Dhamma. I mean, things like television are very bad. Computers too. I mean, okay, but they may have their uses, but they can also be a bit of a damage. Now the trouble is not only the thing, the way we use them, but the effect they're having on the world generally. And that we can't be separate from that because we're in the world. This is the trouble.
Would you say that a bhikkhu fulfills his duties to the laity by being a presence and doing the practice and going on alms round? Is that the minimum or maximum requirements?
Fundamentally, a bhikkhu's got no duties, no obligations to the lay people at all. Mm-hmm. Because it says in the ordination ceremony, I ask for ordination for the sake of obtaining nibbana. And that's the obligation, the duty. We might see it good and helpful to the lay people, and we do it out of compassion and out of metta for them. But fundamentally, there isn't any real obligation whatsoever. People think that, because think that they have an obligation to the lay people, they haven't really. There isn't any. And you get somebody who learns Dhamma and they learn to the point where they can talk and tell people about it. Okay, they talk to lay people and they tell them about it. They don't have an obligation to do that. But they do it just the same because they're human beings and they know that these people have got dukkha and suffering there. And to bring them in the direction of Dhamma can help them to overcome their suffering. And it's also useful because it does help the Sangha. And because of that, one does it. One does these things. But fundamentally, one's obligation is to attain nibbana.
Sometimes there's a confusion between the way the jitta is referred to, different types of jitta. For instance, the original jitta, the jitta outside of the five khandhas, or the Vipassana jitta, or the jitta of very deep samadhi, the base of samadhi, or the jitta of deep insight, the jitta of the arhat. Can you briefly explain how these are different?
Yeah, the true jitta, the original jitta, the basic jitta, all the rest are modifications of that. In talking of the chitta, it's very difficult because we haven't got any true similes. There's nothing like it. But the nearest you can get is to say that the Chit-Dhan is like the ocean, whereas the modifications of the Chit are like waves on the surface of the ocean. They're still part of the ocean. They're still the ocean, really. But at the same time, they give an appearance. They break into the appearance of seeing things that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and so on, in the five countries. These are the waves. They're just ephemeral things, things that arise and cease all the time. And they're not real. They're illusory. A whole lot are illusory, really. I mean, something that doesn't last is not real. It's a little paradox. What exists is not real. And what is real does not exist. The meaning of that is that existence is sensation. It's the only way we can define existence, really, sensation, what we sense. And what is real is permanent. So you can't say that what is permanent exists, because the essence of existence is impermanence, it's change. Everything must change to exist. If things cease to change, they disappear immediately. So everywhere there must be change. And that's not real, because it's never the same thing for two moments together.